I would like to introduce Jennifer. Jennifer Bartlett was born in San Francisco and studied at the University of Mexico, Vermont College, and Brooklyn College. She lives in Brooklyn with her husband, Jim Stewart, a sci-fi writer slash math teacher. Her son, Jeff, who she tells me is named Maximus, and her cat and two pugs. Jennifer is the author of 3 full-length collections of poetry, Derivative of the Moving Image, 2007, A Lullaby Without Any Music, 2012, and Autobiography, Anti-Autobiography, 2014. She co-edited a collection of letters of Larry Agner and with George Hart, and that will appear in this December's issue of Poetry Magazine. In addition, she's edited Beauty is a Verb, New Poetry of Disability, 2011, and she co-founded with her husband the poetry journal St. Elizabeth Street Press, which ran from 1999 to 2003. And she's been blogging since 2006. Bartlett has taught creative writing and English at New York City Department of Education, Montclair State University for United Cerebral Palsy, and the Multiple Sclerosis Society and St. Mark's Poetry Project. She comes to us working on a biography of Larry Agner. Lawrence Joel Agner grew up in Swampscott, and he was first published in Goad 3, and that was in the summer of 52. It was published along with Vincent and Creeley. Jennifer writes, as I go deeper down the well, I realize how important Larry Agner was in the world of poetry and letters. She was at Storrs and said that yesterday she went through letters of Zukofsky, Olson, Creeley, and Charters, and of course, Sid Corman. And I'm beginning to regard Larry as a true anchor, a bridge between poetries, most notably Black Mountain and language poetry. Jennifer is a prose writer and a poet, and like Vincent Farini, she's a poet of her feelings. I came across this poem that is called "The Sun Drawn the Light Across the Strings," and I excerpted a little bit here, and she asks, how much does one's ability to feel the other depend on one's feeling for oneself? How much does one's ability to be for that other depend on one's ability to be for oneself? We are all windows. In a recent email, she remarked that Larry's biography is an opening up of her work where poetry, disability studies, music, and form come from. So please welcome Jennifer Bartlett. Thank you.
Okay. What I put together is short. Is the speaker on?
That's actually just okay. The recording.
There. Okay. So I put together sort of a mishmash of ideas about Larry. I'm not sure how many of you are very familiar with his work. So I thought I'd start. Because I describe Larry's body. Larry had significant cerebral palsy, and I describe his body a lot, but it's sort of hard to visualize what he's actually like. So I decided to play this video for you. It's only 2 minutes. Unfortunately, this video was taken in the last probably few years of Larry's life, so he was sort of worn down, and he looks particularly disabled, more disabled than in previous years. I also have cerebral palsy, and it's not a degenerative condition, but because of the lack of muscle control and the spasticity. It can sort of wear you down as you get older, particularly if you don't do yoga or exercise. And Larry really hated exercise. He actually, one thing people don't know about him is he actually walked. People don't know he could walk, and he walked outside of his house by holding a bar alongside the house and sort of scooting his wheelchair behind him with his foot in case he fell down. And he was in occupational therapy early on, and he hated it. He said it was the worst thing. In fact, he went to a school for middle school called Massachusetts Hospital School that some of you may have heard of. It's in Canton. And Massachusetts was actually one of the most progressive states, unsurprisingly, treating children with disabilities. Because usually what would happen, as would have been the case with Larry, born in 1926, they would have been automatically institutionalized. But Larry's mother, Betsy Eigner, didn't want that, so she took it upon herself to take care of him. Before I go on, I just want to show you. So this, I don't know who filmed this, but this would have been at Larry's house in Berkeley. That was, so Larry died when he was 68, and then I never looked at the date on it. I think it was about 66 or, no, what? He was about 66. So that would have been in the early 90s. He died in, I believe, it was either 94 or 96. And so I want to talk about Larry's physicality, but I realize that I can get very obsessed with that, and I want to talk about the poetry. There are last things I can say, but that typewriter, that was for all intents and purposes his original typewriter, and that was given to him in about 1940 as a bar mitzvah gift. Charles Bernstein told me that usually when you're bar mitzvahed, you get a pen and pencil set, and instead he was given this typewriter, and there are a lot of misconceptions about his ability. Ron Silverman, for example, who's actually a good friend of mine, said that, wrote somewhere that no one thought Larry could speak until he was 30. And that the part of my biography is that I want to get at the real physicality of the truth of what happened to Larry, which is his mother knew from early on that he had no cognitive disabilities whatsoever. I have Larry's baby book under my bed, and she, his mother recorded his childhood development. And then he was sent away to this middle school. And then when he returned home, he was he was attended Swampscott High School through correspondence classes, and then he attended 7 correspondence classes to the University of Chicago. And I've been through all this stuff. I've read the syllabus. He stayed at Chicago. Larry's one of those people who never threw away a piece of paper. So everything is archived. I've read his college papers about the Nazis. I've read the syllabus. I've read the book. Actually, the book he studied was called Approaches to Poetry by a man named two men, one named Chandler, and I can't remember the other one, but Chandler was actually a Twain scholar, not a poetry person. And Hugh Kenner reviewed this book in I think Poetry Magazine and sort of bashed it. So Larry became involved with the Sid Corman, as most of you probably know, was in the radio show on, I think, WMEX, This Is Poetry. This Is Poetry out of Boston. Many people don't know this. It was actually Bob Creeley, Robert Creeley's first public reading was on this radio show, on Sid Corman's radio show. He'd been published in a little journal called Wave, and Corman found him. So Larry wrote to Corman a postcard in 1949 saying that he disagreed with the way Corman presented Yeats on his show. And this started, for whatever reason, a correspondence that lasted from 1949 to until Larry died in 1996. And studying it, you hear all about the development of New American Poetry, which actually Corman was invited to be in, and he declined, although he told Larry, a man's guide to white's guide to. And some of you might know that Robert Duncan actually, like Miriam Gleason and Denise Levertov, Duncan got all those folks into New American Poetry. And Larry was another one of the people that Duncan got in. And Duncan actually typed his Larry's poems for Allen, and the typed scripts are at University of Buffalo. Allen Dondon actually didn't like Larry's writing at first. He thought it was very thin. So, let me see. Are there any questions? Peter Lowfield. Yes, in fact, I'm going to right now. So today I was at the Cape Ann Museum, and the Farini Archive owns about 10 letters from Larry to Vincent. Larry's good. There's a good light this is an example of what Larry's look like. They're how to read. And this is a poem he wrote for Vincent in the middle of this letter. The root in. Every two pages, a quarter of day, where the moon or stars come out, and wise birds toll, know the moment, the plunge of memory, tenacious earth. And Larry notes that this was copied from the Berkeley Review of Books. And then I'd like to read a few more poems. I'm just going to read a couple of my favorite ones. Larry's grandfather would serve a really rich, famous shoemaker. And Larry had a lot of resistance. He was sort of a little commie, and he had a lot of resistance against striving and people running around like chickens with their heads cut off. He really thought that was sort of silly, and this is one of his poems about that. I do so little because the drive of the world is so much. It meets me going the other way through me. And when there is silence, all naked, I sit here trying to hold my breath. But sometimes in the living room, the wind is felt shaking the house. In the blackout, waiting for death, wanting sleep, the walls had nothing more to reflect. The world, the sea, a shock wave, flyers a mile away. There were planes of another country. Afterwards, the sun came around, and they say how the stars will collide. His first book was published, I can't recall the date, but by Creeley's Divers Press on Maokoi, and it was called From the Sustaining Air. And so through Cormie, Matt Olson and Jonathan Williams, and Jonathan Williams on Jargon published Larry's first full-length book called On My Eyes. And there's it's a long, long chapter in the book, because there's this whole comedy around this book that Larry sent it to Olson. Olson was supposed to edit it. Olson basically threw it in a corner. Then Denise Levertov edited it, but she didn't really understand it, so the introduction was very negative, and then Williams was running out of money, so it almost didn't get published. And today, I found this hilarious postcard from Larry to Vincent that says, "I bawled Charles out and repeated what I wanted, and he wrote back he'd look for it, but maybe do without it. But JW still lacks $300. Awful big deal. Well, I feel tired. It's kind of seedy and wild. Then he says, so much ado. Well, no, that was a reference. Oh, he went to see Much Ado Nothing about Nothing in Cambridge. But right before the book came out, he went to Harvard Square to see Levertov give a reading in Harvard Yard, and Olson was there, and that's when he met, I don't know how to pronounce his name, George Carney, is that right? The original owner of the Grolier? Yeah, Carney, yeah. So, does anybody have any questions? Oh, I do remember. It would have been, it was right before Easter, and it was in 1959 or 1960. He also met Robert Lowell at that reading, and he said to Corin, big ponds. That's how he said, that was how he described meeting Robert Lowell. There was big, big ponds. So, yeah, I remember that date because that time is important because he had anxiety about the first book coming out. And he was essentially in a fight with all these people about the financing of the book. And then, so Williams wanted his parents to finance the book. And they got really upset about that. So his mother started throwing out Williams's letters. And then Larry started writing to Williams in French, so his mother couldn't read the letters. But the very funny thing is, he didn't actually know French. So it was like sort of this made-up French. But my really, really dear friend, Andrew, is editing a collection of Larry and Jonathan Williams letters for University of Alabama. But he's quite frustrated because there are no Williams letters. So we've spent a lot of time, you know, looking in different places because this stuff, you think they'd make it easy, but they don't. Everyone has like 5 archives. Sid Corman, it's not like his letters are in one place. They're like in 7. Larry actually has 4 fairly big archives. The biggest is at Stanford, but he has them at Dodd, the NYPL, and Kentucky or something. I can't remember that one. And then little archives all over, so.
So you had to gather all those, right?
Yes, I've been to Dodd a couple of times. I've only been to Stanford once. I paid someone to photograph the letters. Stanford is impossible to deal with. It's It's a very large, understaffed archive with a lot of pressure and a lot of famous. As you probably know, Ginsberg is there, Levertov, Bob Grenier. They just have way too many name brand archives, so it's hard.
Is there much correspondence with Creeley in Eigner's archives?
At Dodd, oh, some of that was published, but they screwed it up.
Oh.
They screwed it up. There are, in last spring's Chicago Review, there was a collection of Creeley and Eigner's letters published. But they edited it in some inappropriate ways, so it's not great. But there's a really beautiful 30 or 40 pages of letters from Creeley to Larry at the Dodd Archive at Storrs. And they're great because they're the first letters that the two wrote. I can't remember. I have some of Eigner to Creeley, but they're the first letters when they met. Essentially the first letters. So it was when Creeley was living at the chicken farm.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So, yes, and they're just really quirky. Creeley was very aggressive. Larry had this habit of, through his whole life, of sort of second-guessing himself, saying that he couldn't retain information or he couldn't read enough or do this. And then he'd go on talking about Whitehead for three pages. So it was sort of like, you know, he was reading staying like Artaud and Whitehead and this, I think it was a Jewish novelist named Shylock, and he read everything. He studied popular mechanics, he liked math, he watched all kinds of stuff on TV. So, but then he would say, like, over and over about how burdened he was psychologically, and he couldn't retain stuff and blah, blah, blah. And Creeley would not have it. He actually really lashed out at Larry for arguing, for talking like that, because Larry said something about him, Creeley being more knowledgeable, him and Corman being more knowledgeable than that, and how would, and then Creeley said, well, how would you know that? How do you know what I read, you know? So, but their relationship was never really adversarial. That was an unusual thing about Larry. He got cranky and from time to time frustrated when people were putting him off about publications, but he was never in any political fights, ever. He didn't fight with people. They didn't upset him in that way. And he had correspondence. He would pretty much answer whoever wrote him. He had long correspondent with Daphne Marley. They have very nice correspondence. And they had another correspondence with David Gittin and Maria Gittin and all that. Yes?
He was living in Swampscott when his first book was published?
Yes.
Did the publication of his work have anything to do with his moving to Berkeley?
No, he didn't move until... So that the book was published in 1960, and he moved in 1978.
I'm just sort of curious about how he entered the world, the literary world, how he started to have a voice, how he started to make contact with these great poets, you know? Was it through having individual poems published in magazines?
Is everything okay, Henry? Okay, it was all through letter and through these long correspondences, like it all filtered.
How did they get to know his poetry?
He would, I guess he sent them poems in the letter, like Corman introduced him to Creeley. He sent Creeley poems. Creeley decided to publish the little chat book. Then Creeley sent the chat book to Williams Carlos Williams. Then Williams Carlos Williams wrote Creeley a letter about it. And they probably got the Jargon Press published through Olson. Olson hooked him up with Jonathan Williams. That is a really good question, because it was all through letter. There was obviously no internet, and he only read in public a handful of times. The readings I know where he read at the, it's not the same place as now, but he read at the Artist Co-op in Cambridge. I told you that, but it was a different one.
Right.
He read at St. Mark's in the 70s. He read at a bookstore in Marblehead, and they read in Berkeley, and full of time. So he wasn't really out and about. And then eventually, I haven't quite found the connection, but he got connected with Black Sparrow Press, John Martin's press, and they became his regular publisher. I think he had four Black Sparrow books. Oh, and he would also write to, he wrote to James Laughlin. He just wrote to them. He's like, hi, James Laughlin, here's some poems. And then he wrote a play, and then Corman told him to send the play to Duncan, so he sent the play to Duncan, and just came, because as Garrett knows, Duncan was doing plays, right? So, yes.
Tell me about his relationship with Robert Grenier.
Okay. Anything specific you want to know? Anything in particular?
How did Robert Grenier come to meet him to be his caretaker? What was their life in Berkeley like?
Okay. Do you know Bob?
I was in a poetry workshop when I was an undergraduate.
Okay. Well, Bob, I believe, first saw Larry's work at the Grolier in the 70s. he taught Franconia, and he started writing Larry. And they traveled. No, it couldn't have been the 70s. I'm blanking on the date. It might have been the early 70s. But Bob took little Amy, his daughter. They went to Swampscott to meet Larry. And Bob was Bob was so enchanted with Larry's work from the beginning. He just was totally in love with it. So they wanted to put him in this. It must have been the 70s because Barrett Watton and Bob had the language poet magazine called This, and they published him in that. And
73, 74, I think.
Yeah. It seems like it should have been longer because they started living together in 80, but so coincidentally, Richard Eigner had moved to Berkeley with anticipation of Larry moving out there. And to answer part Peter's question, he moved out there because his father, Israel, died, and his mother physically could not care for him. So Richard and his wife, Beverly, moved out. They lived in Japantown first, and they're all very involved with Duncan. Richard, Larry's other brother knew Duncan, his cousin knew Duncan. They're all friends with Duncan. So they thought this would be the best place for him because they knew about the disability rights movement in the Center for Independent Living that started in Berkeley. And so in 1977 or 78, Larry was sent out there to live with Richard. Larry lived for a year or two in a group home, and they tried to hook him up with the CIL. It didn't go too well. Larry had very, very significant social issues. And if you ever met him, you probably saw that. Not because of his disability, but because of the way he was raised. He was very isolated, and Bob Grenade said he used to have a on-off button. He would either talk, or be told to be quiet. He had absolutely no idea how to have a two-way conversation. So this made Larry not be able to take part in independent living. Then Bob was living with Kathleen Frumkin, and they got the idea that they would move into a house together. And Kathleen has a son named Ezra, and Bob has daughter Amy. I don't know if you know, but Bob was a single father his whole life. I don't think the mother even lived anywhere near them. He was a real single parent. So Richard bought a house, a very nice house on McGee Street for Larry and Kathleen and Bob to live. And so I think Bob still worked at night. He was, as Garrett said, he He was working, he was proofreading for the accounting firm or something, and Kathleen was at school, so they would take shifts taking care of Larry. There always had to be someone home in case Larry fell or something. He didn't have any nurses at that point. And part of their project was to sort of socialize Larry. So they had dinner with him every night with the children. They taught him how to participate in a conversation. They taught him how to dress himself. They taught him how to eat with a spoon. His mother did everything for him. But that's not wholly a product of CP. It's a part of how he was raised. So they took on this project of sort of... So I think the word Bob uses is socializing. And Bob continued to type all of his manuscripts, and Bob's feeling of Larry is he just feels like Larry was a genius, and he was 100% dedicated to fostering and protecting that genius. He was 100% willing to take care of this person because the work was so important to Bob. But one thing led to another, and 10 years passed, and for reasons I actually know a lot of the personal stuff, but Bob is one of my best friends, so I'm not going to tell anybody. Sorry. But because I myself have a strong allegiance to Bob. It's not really about Larry anyway. It's more about Bob's trouble getting work in academia. He felt very outside academia, and he never got hired as a full-time teacher. So he sort of just moved to Bolinas and got his food from the food bank.
Thank you. Larry's socialization work? Did it work well, what Bob was trying to do?
Yes, I think in some ways it worked very well. I think he always had a problem with conversation, but he could dress himself and do a lot of physical things. But then, unfortunately, his life got sort of sad because he lived about 6 years after that, and they never really found someone who cared for him like Bob and Kathleen had. So that he remained in the house, though, because his family owned the house. And the very crucial thing that Bob... happened with Bob was because Bob was Bob, so all these other people were coming over. Creeley stayed a week with them. I think Bear Watton was there, Ron Silverman was there. He was able to meet this whole area group of people, except Robert Duncan never came over to visit. I don't think he came once. And I have this theory that Robert Duncan was actually competitive with Larry and got a lot of his ideas from Larry's typescripts because he was Larry's typist. And in the 60s, and Duncan actually mentions that influence in one interview, but that's never been explored. And that's part of my project, the Larry Eigner Project, that this person had a lot of influence and brought a lot of people in, but since he was such a cripple that he was sort of like, and I use that word ironically, but if you know me, I'm totally hardcore about disability. That I think because of his physicality, he sort of got dismissed. I think about this a lot. I mean, I'm going to say something sort of naughty. In one of the first letters Quigley wrote to Eigner, I smoke a lot of hashish and fuck a lot of women who are not my wife. And I think in New American Poetry, that sort of sums up who's going to get the attention. Like Olson and Quigley had, and Duncan had these huge personalities, and Larry just wasn't out there. Like, we're talking about Lisa Jarno's book on Duncan, which I love, and Lisa, I consider her mentor, but it was like Duncan went here, Duncan went there, Duncan. But Larry didn't actually go anywhere. So my book is a book of bad ideas. It's about things that are cataloged, but like I keep lists of books he was reading in every year because he mentioned all of them in the letter. So this is sort of a book of thoughts.
What about Richard? Did he have his own family life separate then?
That's a great question. I love that question. Yes, Richard and Beverly have a very strong family life. Beverly's actually Sephardic and they're fairly, Beverly in particular is a pretty observant Jewish person, and they had two or three children, and now I think they have grandchildren, and they live in a big house right by Lenhagenian, and yes, they have very, I was over at their house a couple of times, and they're very dedicated to their children.
So they left Larry to Bob, in a way.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. I think Beverly Eigner really had a hard time. She wanted Larry to go to the Center for Independent Living, and she wanted him to be with the disabled people and be independent. Larry did not want to be independent. Bob had to force him to learn how to put his clothes on. He was spoiled. The whole life, and don't say this in a negative way, I'm just saying it as a fact. The whole Eigner household was centered around his needs. He never did anything for himself, which I've always argued made his disability a privilege, because I'm sure all of you are writers. How would you feel You could sit there and write all day and read books and have people bringing you to snacks. If you didn't have a job or a kid or a wife or a husband or any kind of, I mean, that's all he did. He read and wrote and watched things on PBS every day for pretty much his whole life. Yes?
Since you told us that Larry was always questioning himself, I wondered, how did he have the courage to declare that he was a poet? Was there a decisive moment when he says, I am a poet?
His mom was very literary. She grew up, she loved Longfellow and Stevenson, Children, Garden of Verses. I think those were, his mom read those books to him when he was very, very small. And he, one of my chapters is called The Idea of a Boy Poet. And he, from a very young age, he had, he started writing. Peter, I can tell you. Peter wants me to show you. So this is, I'll read it. This is a photo of his, this is the first book he published at the Massachusetts Hospital School when he was in eighth grade. See, this is, so I'll read you the first poem. The first one? Okay. The Blind. How are we doing for time? Okay. A blind man on spring. The hand of nature plucks the strings of all the instruments of spring and makes the wild echoes ring of spring. And now I hear the joyous cry of all birdland as they fly northward through the endless sky of spring. I'm actually not going to read all, but this is, I'll pass it around. So, and then his mother had this idea that he should write, we pass that around. She wanted him to write greeting card jingles so that he would have a job. His family was very, I remember, I was, it's hard to find my manuscript. It's 200 pages, so it's hard to find quotes quickly, but when Ann Charters went to his house, Ann and Sam Charters, there's these notes that Ann took on envelope, and one of the notes was something like, Larry said my parents had no idea what I'm doing. They like poems that rhyme, or something like that. So he, and actually, Richard, his brother, called his opening into projective verse and poems that don't rhyme rebelling against my mother. That's what Richard Eigner called it. What is that, Peter? Yeah. Did someone over there have a question?
Jennifer, I'm curious your entry point with Larry, like when you first discovered him, and then you know, how it built to here you're doing his biography.
My life as a poet is, I'm not in academia, so I don't really, my end goal in my work is sort of spiritual and for my own stability and a bunch of other things. And I actually don't know when I first heard Larry's work. My dad is Lee Bartlett. He was William Everson's biographer, so Brother Antonitis, and he wrote on Duncan a lot and all those people. So I sort of heard of Larry a little bit, and then I went to a marathon reading of Maximus, and I really, really fell in love with Maximus. And then Larry started to come more into my sphere. This wasn't that long ago, about 6 years ago. And I knew who he was before then, but and I read the poems, and what happened, this goes back to the emotion of things. I love biography, and I always wanted to write one. And I was going to write one on Muriel Rue Kaiser, but that didn't pan out. And sorry. Charles, so I was thinking writing on Larry, and then someone said, that's a really good idea. You should do that. And that made me really happy. And then Bob came to read, and Charles Bernstein invited me to go out to dinner to meet Bob. And to be honest, I fell in love with Bob immediately. It was love at first sight. And Bob's enthusiasm for Larry, his warmth, and how they were just really animated about doing the project really made me go forward. And then I met the Eigner family, and I got them to really, really trust me, and I felt close with them. And then that led to all the research, and now I love the research. So that's sort of how it happened. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thank you.
It was mainly, there were just those connections between people. If I met, if Bob had been rude to me or dismissive, or it might have gone another way. But I think Bob sees a lot. Because of the CP, Bob might see a lot of Larry in me. I don't know. And I think it's a really good perspective to write from, because I understand what it's like to have cerebral palsy. And not that may, if you're a able-bodied person, sort of an outsider point of view, it'd sort of be like a man writing a biography of a woman, or a white person writing one of a Chinese person. Not that that's negative, it's just a different viewpoint. And I don't actually think that gets in the way of my... It might get in the way of the book a little, but not... Hopefully not that much. Yes?
Anything about Vincent Farini and the researches in the Farini house? I know he was here in Gloucester in 77. I presume he was visiting Vincent.
Yes, I didn't... I was in the archive today, and I read the letter that Palmy wrote for Vincent, and then I read the letter where he spoke about Charles, and then I wanted to pass around. This sort of shows how messy he got. This was a late postcard he sent to Vincent. And then he also mentioned a visit. He wants Vincent to come visit. He wants to come have a visit in summer of 1972. I'm still developing that section of the book, so there are, and you, so you guys, do all of you know about Larry's participation in the Four Winds, and do all of you know that story? Oh, well, you know the story about Charles writing about the negative review of Four Winds in Letter 5. Okay, well, Larry was actually the one who challenged. I thought, oh, you didn't know this? Okay, well, I'm going to read to you this. This is from The Gist of Origin, and it's written by Corman. So, this is after the Vincent and Olson. I guess this is maybe the first time they saw each other after Maximus was published, and it was at Charles's reading at the Charles Street Meeting House in Boston, September 11th, 1956. And... okay. What can I read? It was destined to be a dramatic occasion, since it was the first meeting of Olson and Farini after appearance of the Jargon edition Maximus 1-10. I'd read the entire book to an audience that included Helen Stein, who was also fond of Vin. She raged at Olson's attack and shredded him for humorlessness and callousness. But the dagger fallen. Vince was profoundly hurt. I'm going to skip ahead. Larry Eigner had been alerted to Olson's coming, and his father duly delivered him. Olson took a seat opposite Larry in his wheelchair by the fireplace. Vin was seated on the rug beside Charles. The big man read a little upon request from his poetry and asked if there were any questions. Larry spends magically trying to find the words, and Charles Olson, frankly, unnerved at the task of trying to cope with the garbled sounds, came out with, finally, he repeated by someone else in the audience, "Why did you attack Vince in your poem?" Olson flushed, and the room was exceptionally quiet as he began to work out a reply, naturally in terms of the larger thesis involved and not as a personal attack. This wasn't quite coming off, at which point, unexpectedly, his wife, Con, who had been visiting by North Shore Town, entered to his transparent relief and joy. I never saw so large a man and moved so fast as he eagerly embraced her, and the scene ended there. And then, toward the end of Maximus, I'm pretty sure it's toward the end, there's this guy that says to Olson something like, "Why do you write poetry? What's the use of writing poetry?" And it's Larry Eigner. So that was one of the connections. And Four Winds comes up a lot in the letters because Larry was a good reader of all that stuff. He got all the magazines and he was very conscientious.
Feeling for language and his approach to poetry?
I think his work is very, very lyrical. It's fragmented but lyrical, but I know more about the way he used the page and the way he did spacing than I mean, early on he talked a lot about his inability to rhyme. His thing was immediacy and force. That was his saying, that he wanted the words to be very forceful. And his work was very, very formed by Sig Horman's ideas, because Sig Horman was looking at all the letters, at all the poems constantly. And I really got the feeling that it's hard to parse what Sid was getting at, but I think he was encouraging Larry to par down a lot, to simplify, to use less words, to not worry about too much about meaning or narrative. And then, of course, from Olson and Duncan, he got the idea of using the page as a score, sort of writing all over the page. And the line breaks, the spaces are extremely calculated. Someone asked me the other day if I thought they were random because of a CP, and they're actually not, because I have a pile of his books, and when he would get his books or magazines, he would mark where the mistakes were, like the space. If one space was off, he would mark it in the book. But he stayed, William Carlos Williams. He was getting a lot out of Williams, and terms of dialect and but he didn't quite write in dialect.
His language seems really physicalized.
Yeah.
Direct. Make some kind of association between the feeling in his language and his poetry and his physicality.
Well, but on the other hand, when he first started, he was writing those very formal, almost sonnet-like poems. So maybe it definitely was not something he came to on his own. But it did match his body.
Well, his energy.
Yeah.
That's what that really meant.
Yeah.
I was just thinking way earlier that at the time that Eigner and Creeley met, Creeley was actually influenced by I.A. Richards' philosophy
That's
of basic
right.
English. And
That's
I
right.
think that there's this whole history of basic English, simple, precise English under the projective guise, but it's more the minimalism of the word choice and the energy packets of each word choice. And that would be a beautiful thread from Creeley to Corman, Eigner, and
yes.
Rainier.
With yes.
His postcard, oh, his index card poem, do you know it?
Yes.
Absolute concretion of sensibility and energy into these explosive fragments.
I'm really glad you brought that up because in the letters he was talking, in those early letters, 50-51, he was talking about basically, bless you, and I, Richard, and I, and...
So he and Creeley shared that?
Well, Creeley taught him about that.
I see.
Creeley knew about that. But the reason why I'm glad you brought it up is because when I asked people about that, people either had no idea what I was talking about, or they said, well, that was very... Creeley was on that for 5 minutes. He didn't really. And do you guys know what basic English is? Yeah, it's like it's a right away teaching English where they turn the language into...
Richards was interested in literacy in Latin America,
uh-huh.
So he wanted people to be literate with a 500 to 800 word vocabulary.
Right,
and
right.
That really impressed Creeley.
Yeah, well, obviously. I don't know how people don't see that connection. Because his poems have
probably 800 words. Where Eigner was coming from, you know,
yeah.
He had difficulty typing and everything, so why waste energy, you know?
Yeah.
Just think about how to get it down as minimally and strongly as possible.
And I did actually look at that book. I did look through the words
yeah.
of that book. I did read about it, but I had to move on. I can't fixate on everything. And then people told me that wasn't that important. But I think you're right. I think you have a good point. Any other questions? Okay.
Jennifer has books for sale if anybody's interested.
Well, they're my books.
Oh, you bring any?
I did bring it, yeah.
There's a few over here.
Yeah.
It has a photograph by Emma B. on it. Do you guys know Emma B. Bernstein? She was a great photographer. She passed away.
But Charles's daughter.
Charles's daughter. Photographer.
Oh, I thought you said pornographer.
Emma B. Bernstein.
So, okay. Thank you.
There's some wine here, people, and some snacks.
Thank you for coming.
You're welcome. Thank you.